Welcome to Parshas Naso. Now, Naso has within a number of different topics, continuation of what we had last week with the different families of the Levites and their numbers and their jobs in terms of traveling and transporting the Mishkan. And then Naso goes into some interesting topics, such as the law of the sota, the wife that was suspected of adultery, and also the priestly blessing, which we recite on Yom Tov and Friday night, parents to children, rabbis to bar mitzvah people. We also have the law of the Nazir, the Nazirite, man or woman, who takes a vow on themselves to refrain from that which is permitted, namely wine, for a period of time, temporarily, in order to come closer to God. And there's some other restrictions included in that, such as not cutting the hair, not defiling oneself to the dead. So we have the notion of an individual accepting upon themselves a certain period of intensity, extra restrictions to discipline oneself and come closer to God. And then we have also, in the second half of the Parsha, the story of the inauguration of the Mishkan, which had been built but now was ready to be set up, and how the 12 leaders of the tribes brought offerings and presents with which to inaugurate the temple and the altar. And the famous repetition of each of the presents, each of the offerings, even though they were all identical. This is something which many people discuss. Why did the Torah repeat it so many times, making this the longest parsha in the Torah? My approach to the parsha, of course, as you can guess right now, is what does Rabbi Dessler speak about? And I couldn't really find too much. Actually, I looked up the word Nazir, and I see that in the second volume he mentions it, and I look back and I say, oh, that's the volume where it goes through the different parshas and even into the prophets. And then I remembered Rav Dessler writes at length about the story of the famous Nazir in the Tanakh. Who's that? Shimshon, Samson. And then I said, of course, that's the Haftorah. The Haftorah of Naso is the beginning of the story of Samson. Now, the story of Samson occupies about 4 chapters in the book of Judges. And those of us who have been studying on Monday nights, we've, this year, not too long ago, have studied the book of Judges and read the story of Samson. And I thought this is a great opportunity to read what Rav Dessler has to say about the story of Samson. And I know that it's very significant because I know that some 20, 25 years ago, there was a rabbi from New York, former student of Ner Israel, you know, from the previous generations, perhaps a contemporary of Rabbi Rosenbaum, maybe a little older. And he is an accomplished teacher and a mentor and dean in his own right in the yeshiva in Staten Island. His name is Rabbi Gershon Weiss. And many years ago, before Art Scroll was publishing, before there were a lot of English books, he wrote a volume called Samson's Struggle. Has anyone ever heard of that? Now I did not study it, but it's a whole book just about, you know, the traditional rabbinic, Talmudic, Midrashic approach to Samson. And I'm sure that what he was motivated was to paint Samson in a light different than the rest of the world paints him. Some type of a romantic womanizer, You know, I don't know what I was going to ask everybody what their impressions of Samson is, but I'm sure that it doesn't make him look too good in the eyes of the Torah scholars and Torah students such as ourselves. And Rav Weiss wrote extensively on this character. I don't know if he refers to Rav Dessler's commentary in this essay. My guess is that if he had access to Rav Dessler's book, that he did, because it's it seems to be a formidable source on it. Now, a disclaimer is that I started studying this myself only a short while ago, and I'm sure that I'm not adequately prepared and equipped to really give you a faithful rendition. But I nevertheless had to come with something to tell you, and I was always been very interested in what Rav Dessler has to say about Shimshon, and I'm going to humbly put forth my understanding at this point in my my studies for you. It comes with a number of introductions, so we're not going to meet Samson just yet. Put that on hold. But Rav Dessler actually opens up the essay with a discussion of the whole notion of Kedusha, what we translate as holiness. What is Kedusha? What is holiness? Holiness, Kedusha, the word Kedusha is translated as separation. Staying away from, basically, from evil. Holiness also is defined, in another sense, as designation. Like when you sanctify something, you take some property, an animal, some flower, or any property, and you designate it as holy. You say, this will be a donation to the temple, or this will be used as an offering. Likewise, when a man and a woman marry, there is a ceremony called betrothal, kiddushin, where the man declares to the woman, you are hereby designated to me. Now, what does the concept of designation have to do with the other concept or the other definition of separation? Rav Dessler says, because they're really two sides of the coin. Anytime you are makdish something, anytime you sanctify something, what you're saying is, it's off limits for this and designated for that. The act of betrothal accomplishes that this woman is forbidden to any other man. Why? Because she is designated for this man. It is separation for the purpose of designation. Likewise, the Torah, the laws of the Torah commands us to stay away from things, stay away from forbidden foods, stay away from forbidden marriages, stay away from sin. What the Torah is saying is, stay away from that which takes you away from God, and thereby, by staying away from those things, you are becoming more attached to God. Kedusha is something which removes us from one aspect of life and brings us closer to another aspect of life. That is the purpose of the commandments. It's not just to make life miserable. On the contrary, it's to make us closer to God. It's something that Kedusha is something that is totally consuming. It's not just about staying away from certain activities. It's something about identifying and aligning oneself with a certain purpose and goal in life. As we continue to sanctify ourselves through the commandments and through the purity of our thoughts, what we do is we separate ourselves more and more from mundane existence, which may have its own purpose. A person that lives, let's say, for worldly pleasures, so that's his purpose, that's his goal, that's his aspiration. And what Kedusha is, the quest for Kedusha, is to separate from that, to say, I'm not living for any other purpose. I have no interests in worldly things for their own sake. My purpose in everything that I do is to connect with God. And I'm living in this life, which is the life, as we know from Rabbi Luzzatto, of the mixture of good and evil. I'm living through this life, materialism versus spirituality, all for the purpose of approaching Olam Haba, the world to come, which is a total and eternal bond with God. When a person lives with the quest for Kedusha, he continues to draw nearer and nearer to God, and with that comes a lot of great benefits. Do you know what the model or what the paradigm for a life of Kedusha is depicted as in the Torah? The Anane HaKavod, the clouds of glory. The clouds of glory, which was the habitat of the Jewish people throughout the years of the desert. It's very germane to the book of Bamidbar. They lived a life of total Kedusha. That means, and he says, we are taught in Chazal that it was through the merit of Aaron HaKohen, the high priest, Aaron, that we had the Anane HaKavod. But Aaron HaKohen was able, through his quest for Kedusha, for his single-minded focus of connecting with God, he was able to bring and inspire the entire Jewish people to be on such a level of focus, of Kedusha, of separation from any other purpose of being other than the purpose of connecting with God, that they were so close to God that God enveloped them with his protective clouds and made them invulnerable to harm, to attack by nations, to any detrimental conditions of climate, of the scorching heat. They had all their needs were cared for, their food, their water, their clothing were, the sages tell us, grew with them. They didn't wear out. They were cool, climate control. They lived the most pristine life, physically and spiritually, because they were under the clouds, under the influence of Kedusha. And that Kedusha was inspired to the highest level by Aaron. And indeed, when Aaron passed away, the sages tell us that the clouds were no longer there. They disappeared. Now, we're talking about Kedusha on a global scale that encompassed the entire Jewish people. Now, that doesn't mean to say that every individual was necessarily on his highest level of Kedusha. In fact, the vast majority were able to be inspired by this and to maintain their personal involvement, but there were those that didn't. And this is why we find in the Torah, for example, in the end of Ki Tsetse, when we read about the attack of Amalek. Now, Amalek came and attacked the Jewish people. The question is, how could they attack? They were surrounded by the clouds of glory. So the Torah says in the end of Ki Tsetse, this is what we read, that extra reading, Zachor, before Purim. It says how Amalek was able to attack them. Remember what Amalek did to you on the way when you were leaving Egypt, that he happened upon you on the way and he struck those of you who were hindmost, all the weaklings at your rear, when you were faint and exhausted and he did not fear God. The only people that Amalek could attack were those who were weaklings at your rear. Kol ha-nechesh sholim acharecha They were straggling behind. Who were these people that were straggling behind? Says Rashi, Chaserei Koach, people that were weak, Machmas Chetam, because of their sin. Shehayah Anan Poltan, and the clouds spit them out. What that means is that people who are not on the, personally, on the level of the Kedusha, of the Klal, of the group, did not earn, did not enjoy that protection, because they were not on that wavelength. They had not sufficiently focused themselves to the highest degree with God that would earn them that protection from God. And so therefore they were stragglers, and those were the people that were vulnerable by attack. Now, what can be done in God's plan of this desert society, which was, Rav Dessler says, was the highest level the Jewish people ever lived on, and never will approach that until the times of Mashiach, the desert years? Was there a plan to help those stragglers? And Rav Dessler says yes. And this is amazing.
By who?
By God. Remember, we have been talking about the formation of the different tribes around the camp of Israel.
Yeah.
Well, there was a certain formation and a reason for that. And one of them, one of the features of this camp, was that there was one tribe that brought up the rear, so to speak. That tribe was the tribe of Dan. Dan is called the tribe in chapter, this is next week's Parsha, in chapter 10. It's called the Nosa Degel Machane B'nei Dan. This is you don't have to look, it's very short, page 785. The Nosa Degel Machane B'nei Dan Mi'aseif L'chol HaMachanos. Then traveled banner of the camp of the children of Dan, the rear guard of all the camps. The rear guard.
Oh, they were descendants from the son, right?
Hmm?
They were a descendant from one of the 12 sons.
Right.
But the stragglers were the mixed multitudes who were descended of nobody.
Right, the stragglers could have been anybody, but there was a tribe stationed at the back, at the rear, to gather them in. So what does it mean they were why did they go into the rear? So Rashi says, more simple explanation, that they were there to pick up lost objects. And they would pick them up and return them to their owners. But Rav Dessler, citing a Midrash, says that they were there to help those who lagged behind because they were not on the level of holiness of the rest of the nation. And like Rashi says about Amalek, the clouds couldn't contain them; they fell out of the clouds. And so there was the tribe of Dan. Now, why was Dan chosen for this very important job? And what they really had to do was they really had to reach out to those members of the nation that were not on the high level. So Rav Dessler points to the blessing that Jacob gave to Dan, and the blessing that Moshe gave to Dan. You know, Jacob spoke to his sons, and Moshe spoke to the tribes, and he finds references in there that Dan had tremendous strength. Dan is compared to the strength of Judah. I'm not going to read all the verses.
Dan?
Yeah. Dan was compared in many ways to Yehuda. In fact, Yehuda, we know, is the tribe that produces the Mashiach. Well, Dan had that Mashiach-like quality. And what exactly is that Mashiach-like quality? It's the quality which enables a person, after having achieved the highest level of Kedusha, the highest level of focus, to be able to remove oneself from the nucleus, to take oneself out of the clouds of glory, but to be powered with one's own holy power pack, and to go out and help go down to those who need to be brought up. You will only find that quality by someone who is an extreme level of holiness. Because if not, for a person to separate, if a person is not on that level himself, and he separates himself from the protective clouds of glory, then if he goes out to those who are weak, he's likely to be dragged down by them. We're talking about a quality of an individual or a group that not only do they stick with the group in their level of holiness, but they can carry it with them, and they can remove themselves and still maintain it. This is a quality which Rav Dessler refers to, and it's actually one of the, if you ever study those words and the counting of the Omer, different qualities and different combinations, 49 different combinations, this is the quality of Gevura Shebikedusha, strength within holiness. Not only reaching holiness, but having the strength to take that holiness and remove yourself from the nucleus. This is the quality that Mashiach needs, because Mashiach is going to come to a world which is very likely, very far from perfection, very far from redemption, and he's going to be able to influence people to come back. So we have, you know, Aaron on the one hand creating that climate of Kedusha for everyone to follow, but then you have the tribe of Dan who is there to catch those who fall between the cracks. Guess who is the hero from the tribe of Dan? Shimshon. Shimshon is from the tribe of Dan. Now, before we get to Shimshon's story, let me also point out that the tribe of Dan also has a certain negative quality. Somebody brought up, I think maybe last week or the week before, the story in Emor about the man who cursed God.
Oh, yeah.
I think you brought it up. This man was the son of an Egyptian man, and his mother was from where? Which tribe?
Dan.
Tribe of Dan. How did this woman get involved with an Egyptian man?
Because they were all my friends there. They were right. She was vulnerable.
Yeah, she was vulnerable. Now, the truth is, she was tricked. It's not something that she did. She thought this man entered her tent. She thought it was her husband.
Yeah.
But Rav Dessler says that these kinds of accidents don't happen to people who don't have a little flaw in inclination. And I didn't know this, but the Torah speaks, Moshe Rabbeinu speaks at the end of the Torah about, he warns, and this is incredible, I mean, he warns us about the possibility of a person warning against idolatry. Parshas Nitzavim, I'm sorry I'm jumping around, but Rav Dessler does that to us. Parshas Nitzavim in 1087, beginning of the chapter 29, verse 17. Perhaps there is among you a man or woman or a family or a tribe whose heart turns away today from being with Hashem, our God, to go and serve the gods of those nations. Perhaps there is among you a root flourishing with gall and wormwood. Moshe is saying there may be, you know, everyone here is with the program, but there may be some among you that are not totally pure. Rav Dessler says that he had somebody from the tribe of Dan in mind. Why? Because Dan had an inclination. What was this inclination? This one incident. This one incident for this woman who was taken by accident because she had a 0.0001 inclination. And that's already like, uh-oh, watch out for them. We're talking about the Jewish people who are as close to perfection as you can imagine. But what's going on here? The same tribe that we have to be careful for is the tribe that has the quality of Mashiach? Yes. Because the quality of Mashiach is to be able to go out and meet the stragglers. And therefore, it may be that one slight ounce of inclination is what that tribe needs to be able to reach out to those who are fallen from that inclination and pull them up. In other words, the tribe of Dan was 99.9999% holiness and 0.0001 inclination, and that put them at the perfect point of being able to save the stragglers. That's who Shimshon is. Shimshon was this amazing holy man who could remove himself from the hood, so to speak, and go out and do acts of holiness. Let's to set the record, what exactly do we mean by the life of Shimshon? It's four chapters, but the Parsha, really, the Haftorah, really just deals with the birth. But we see that Shimshon came on the scene. He was appointed as a judge by God to save the Jewish people from the Philistines. Generally, when the Jews were under attack during this period of time, when they realized that it was because of their sins, they repented and God sent a Savior. And the Savior came and sent this nation reeling and put an end to all this suffering. That didn't happen in the case of Shimshon. In the case of Shimshon, there was not really a full salvation from the Philistines. The Philistines continued to hound them for years to come. But Shimshon was given to the Jewish people by God to cause the Philistines a lot of grief. And what he did was, by his ability to detach and infiltrate the Philistine people, he was able to form bonds with them, sometimes with women, with wives, with Gentile wives, form bonds with them, and to create pretenses to take revenge against them. And he did. His purpose then was to make life very difficult and miserable for the Philistines. It was not a complete salvation, but he caused them a lot of grief because he was able to detach. Make no mistake, Rav Dessler says on black and white, none of his relationships with those women were sinful in the slightest. None of them. There are times when a person who is on the right level has permission to deviate from the law for the sake of the greater good. Example, Esther. Example, King Solomon. King Solomon, the king is forbidden by the Torah to take more than, 18 wives? He took 1,000. Certainly they have to convert. His wives didn't convert sincerely. Yes, yet this was his attempt to bring redemption to the world. And he had the permission called Horoas Shah, an emergency, and he had permission. And it was not sinful in the slightest what he did. And it was not sinful in the slightest what Samson did.
Mistake. First person King Solomon married was one of the daughters from one of the pharaohs. Hashem became very mad. King Solomon remarried the pharaoh's daughter.
Okay.
And never forgave Solomon.
Okay. Okay, that may be it. The fact that... Yeah.
Then it's embellished on that Samson.
Samson was not motivated by lust. He was not motivated by desire in the slightest. He was a superman who was on the highest level of Kedusha. God gave him to the Jewish people in order to do the kind of acts that he did, and this is the way he succeeded in doing it. You know, like an Esther. It was not sinful in the slightest. He had permission under the the category of Horoas Shah, of a timely need, and all that he did was with the utmost purity, sanctity, and a proper kavana. So, I mean, he just takes any notion that we have of Samson as being a lust-hungry person who couldn't control his passions. He just throws it out the window. Again, don't take my word for it. Read probably Rabbi Weiss's book also, Samson's Struggle. Now, we know, however, that Samson, in the end, he fell. He was a Nazir, and this is also part of his Kedusha, part of his strength of holiness, was through his Nazirus, his Nazirism. But in the end, he lost his power, he poked out his eyes. Where did he go wrong?
He got a haircut.
How did that happen to him? How did he sink?
He was too trustful toward his wife. He made it the wrong way.
No. He didn't make any of the petty mistakes that we think.
He talked to you.
Just like, and also King Solomon didn't make any of the petty mistakes that we think. Rav Dessler says that the downfall of both Solomon and Samson had nothing to do with lust, had nothing to do with holiness. It had to do with gava. Had to do with pride. When you have a person who is so outstanding, so beyond everyone else, every peer, that he is not only holy to the point of being at the center of the clouds of glory, but that he is strong enough to withdraw from the clouds of glory and carry the holiness with him, there can be a slight inclination to feel pride. That's the downfall. That is the downfall. There's both great tzaddikim, both great men, Shlomo and Shimshon, are quoted in the Tanakh as saying, using the word I. That's it. Shlomo HaMelech said, I will have more than the minimum number of wives, and my heart will not be turned away. Ani. And Shimshon said to his parents, Kachli kihi yashra be'enai. Take this woman as a wife for me because she is straight in my eyes. Straight in my eyes means I'm totally driven by holiness here. But he said the word kachli, take for me. Or she's right in my eyes. Just like that, again, that 0.001% of pride, as if, look at me, I have the ability to do this, rather than, I am a servant of God, my power comes from God, I am not seeking any personal acclaim for what I have accomplished, and this is all the shem shamayim for the sake of heaven. That one degree of deviation from the wholehearted kavana, intention to do solely for the sake of heaven, is disastrous for people on this level, because they're so out on a limb, they're so beyond the pale, you know, they're so beyond the group, and that they have to see themselves as a treading on thin ice, and not at all to attribute personal quality to that, to their strength. And when he fell in that one point of pride, that's at the end he ended up suffering, even in the area of his relationships with his wives, and he gave in to her requests and so forth. You have to read the whole story. But it all started because of pride, not because of a lack of holiness. Okay, putting this all into a usable format. Number one, I mean, to what I can glean from this. Number one is that we have to realize that our strength as the Jewish people is Kedusha. Kedusha. Do we want to be protected? Do we want to be cared for? Do we want to be provided for by God? Attach ourselves to God. If we focus on Him, He'll focus on us. there is a nucleus, God willing, in every generation, a nucleus of righteous people that are holding the banner high. And we have to try to get into that cloud with them. And yet there will be people that won't stick with it, and they'll straggle behind. And there can be people, activists, that have this so much attachment to holiness that they actually have a strength, a gevura, a strength, a personal strength of holiness, that they can take it and go out and help those people. They may actually relate to what they're doing because they may have a slight experience that they have perhaps overcome, and that makes them particularly attuned to where they're at. But they can reach out and bring them back in. But those workers have to be 1,000% pure in their kavana. We don't hold them to be petty people. We're not afraid of them being unholy, because if they were unholy, they wouldn't be able to do what they're doing at all. But because of their great level, because of their great spiritual strength, they have to be extremely, extremely mindful and careful that they don't let any degree of the I, of the pride mix in, because that will be their downfall. So this gives again, I've simplified it a lot, but this gives us a little glimpse into the great people in our Torah. They're not simple people at all. Shimshon was one of the greatest, not one of the weakest, and same with Shlomo HaMelech. Because of their great strength, that they fell. But it's this point of the pride and a lack of wholehearted, single-mindedness of L'shem Shamayim, only working for God, without the ego, without the sense of self present almost at all.
Typical jock. Typical jock.
No, not a typical jock. Anyways, I hope that made some sense. And I found it very, very intriguing. I'd personally like to delve into this more at the right opportunity. But it's good for us to be at least aware, exposed to the way that someone like Rav Dessler even begins to approach these stories in our history.
Oh yeah.